On this week's 51%, we meet a film director who almost quit the business.
I asked him what kind of a budget did he have, and he said he had $700. My life story. Literally my life story.
And hear about an alternative healthcare program for female veterans. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Believe them when they say that it's left for yesterday. And the records that I play, please forgive me for all I've done.
Lisa France says she is fascinated by pioneers and has done her own share of trailblazing. At age 12, she was the first girl to play Pop Warner football. Then, while playing Division I basketball at Brooklyn College, she filed a gender discrimination case against the athletics department over the lack of funding for women's sports, a suit she won and reportedly was the first to receive a monetary award in a suit under Title IX. She played professional basketball for the Manchester Giants in the United Kingdom before moving into film as a stunt double on Spike Lee's He Got Game. She wrote and directed three indie features prior to making her debut documentary, Roll With Me, A Journey Across America. The documentary is about Gabriel Cordell, a paraplegic who set out to become the first person to roll across the United States in a standard manual wheelchair, a 3,100-mile journey from the Pacific Coast to the Atlantic Coast, the final destination being his hometown of West Hempstead, New York. I spoke with France the day of her East Coast premiere of Roll With Me in the fall of 2017 at the Woodstock Film Festival. France said that before embarking on Roll With Me, she had hit rock bottom.
I was at rock bottom in my life. I was about to quit the business, actually. And I got a weird email. There's a group of women, it's called the Alliance of Women Directors. And I've been getting, we get emails all the time in the group. And, I look at them and there was an email and it said, there's a guy who is going to, a paraplegic, who's going to push his wheelchair across the United States and needs a film crew. And I was like, get out of here. That's just bananas. So I am very attracted to stuff like that, and I didn't know if anyone had ever done that before. And I immediately Googled to see if I could find anything, and I could not find anything. The circumference of the wheel on a standard wheelchair, the entire roll bar where you use your hand to push is the entire circumference of the wheel. But in racing chairs or in modified chairs, the wheels are bent in because it makes it easier for your arms and your shoulders. So they bend them in a little bit and the circumference of the push is smaller. It's about, it's like a quarter, if even less. So they only have to push the wheel a little bit and the whole wheel goes around. But Gabe's chair, the roll bar, the push bar, is the entire circumference of the wheel. So that's crazy. No brakes, no seatbelt, no helmet, no pads, no nothing. He took a standard chair, like a regular chair, and he's a paraplegic from his chest down. So he has no balance. He can't feel anything. So it was a little different. And then there were a couple of other guys who had gone across, but again, they had modified chairs with parachutes and brakes and other kinds of wheels, but Gabe decided to take a regular chair. So no one had ever done that. And I thought, well, okay. So I wanted to meet him.
But what are you thinking at this? Are you thinking, here you were saying, I'm about to get out of the business and, whatever, this is crazy, as you said, bananas. Like, what was the attraction?
Well, when I met him, I fell in love with him immediately. I knew him in a weird way. I was connected to him. Like, his energy and the fact that he said he was going to do it, and that was that, and he was doing it, and to be honest, he had no reason to be able to do it. He was a recovering drug addict. He was only off of crystal meth and coke for 8 months when I met him. He was a career smoker of marijuana, cigarettes. And, Gabe, he was very much like, just quit, cold turkey. I can do it.
And why was rock bottom for you? I mean, wanting to get out of the industry doesn't sound rock bottom to me. That's just wanting to get out of the industry.
I just couldn't deal with the no's anymore. I mean, this business is brutal for anyone. I don't care what you are. You can be a chimpanzee, a dog, a woman, a guy. It doesn't matter. The film business is brutal, and it's changed profoundly. And I feel like I've constantly just been on the wrong. I'm like, damn, I'm like 3 months too late. I mean, I was the first woman to shoot an HD movie. Nobody really was ready to do that. Like, I dusted off a HD CineAlta camera out of Boston Camera in Connecticut. We drove up to get the package. They're like, oh, dude, you can have it. Get it out of here. Like, nobody was shooting that. But everyone's like, what? You used what? And we're like, yeah, man, digital. I was like, you're crazy. And then my second film, I did the same thing. I bought two DVX-100s and we just... And meanwhile, just months later, Steven Soderbergh did a huge article. American Cinematographer did an 11-page article on the DVX-100 Panasonic camera. And I was like, see, I'm a little ahead of the game here. But I wasn't. Like, I was, like, too early. And in some cases, I was too late. Like, I was too early. Everything I did was digital, and people were still showing film. And then, after, it was so fast. Like, okay, now, I mean, it literally, the cameras were changing by the day. And then now there's Hulu and next Amazon and everyone's streaming. And like, I couldn't even, the one person's now doing three or four jobs. Like, you can't just direct. You have to write, direct, produce, edit, probably shoot. Like, you have to be able to do everything. And the specialization and the craft of filmmaking was starting to disappear for me. And I became disenchanted by that. And then it's like, well, who do you call? And like, how do you get a job anymore? Like, all of the, what I knew... And I just felt kind of lost. And also, I was an independent filmmaker, like truly independent. Like, I raised all my own money with my team, 2 Spirit Award nominations, bazillions of wins, like on And Be Real in particular, my first film, The Unseen One things, Love and Suicide screened in theaters for 16 weeks. I mean, we sold all of our films to Stars and Showtime and Encore and Netflix, and before anybody even knew what Netflix was.
So you're disenchanted, I get it. And I was so like, you meet Gabe, you've got this connection with this guy.
And I said no.
You said no.
I said no. I asked him what kind of a budget did he have, and he said he had $700. My life story. Literally my life story. I said, buddy, I adore you already, but I just can't keep working for free. This is just... And he said, no, it's cool, I get it. He has like a great New York accent. And he said, no, it's cool. Like, you know, it's okay. And I said, but listen, I will make you like an Indiegogo or a Kickstarter video or something. And, you know, we'll see what happens. So I didn't think really anything was going to come of it. He wanted to leave on April 1st. I met him in like the third week of February. So I basically had from the end of February to make the video, edit it, get up a campaign. I'd never done that before. Again, a new world, right? Crowdfunding. Like, this is, you know, this is 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. I made the video and I started getting a lot of phone calls because it was very touching, you know, and it was very rip your guts out kind of a video. And that's probably my specialty. You know, that's what I do. And my coach... My high school football coach called me from Dublin, Ohio. And it's a long story I'm not going to get into, but I played professional basketball, Division I, college, whatever. And when I was in high school, I broke into the gym so that I could practice more. And he caught me. So I adopted the nickname Gym Rat. So he called me. I haven't talked to him in years. He's like, hey, Gym Rat, what are you doing? Saw your video. And I said, yeah. He's like, a lot of money you need there. I said, yeah. He's like, can't get you that much, but I could get you a little something to start you up. And I said, well, that would be great. And in my mind, I knew I needed like at least $30,000 just to leave. And I was trying to raise $200,000, which is nothing to do a movie on the road. I mean, that's a snack. So we ended up raising almost $35,000. And I was able to rent an RV. I planned, like, first of all, who knows how to do this? Like, what do you, like, there's no book. Like, here's how you take care of a paraplegic who's going to push his wheelchair across. Like, there was no navigation system for this project. No film team. It was just me. I had no one or anything.
Who's caretaking for him?
Well, so then I asked him, I said, what about your needs? Like, what do you, you know? And he said, well, we got to get somebody who could pick me up because we couldn't get a wheelchair accessible RV because we didn't have enough money. So someone who could pick him up. So that was like a job, right? Picking him up, taking him in, taking him out, taking him in, taking him out. So I I didn't know what I was doing. I was like, okay, I'm guessing we need an RV, we need a car, and we need a couple bikes, I think.
And some human muscle.
And some humans that could drive the RV with driver's licenses, right? Like someone who wasn't afraid of it, because, you know, it was like a one-bedroom apartment, you know, with seven people in it. And I slept in my car. So the guys slept in the RV, and I slept in my car.
Were you the only woman
I was the only woman, yeah. It was like a lot of men and me. And we ticked every box. We had, you know, Gabe and his nephew are Palestinian Catholics. Josh Streeter is a Jew. We have the great American white male Christian Link, who's, you know, basically said he has Asperger's. I had a Marine vet with PTSD from Guatemala. We had two recovering drug addicts, a paraplegic, and a lesbian.
What could possibly be wrong with this picture?
This is just the ultimate.
The diversity tour.
It's the diversity tour. It was, as we say in the film, the bad news bears of doing anything. And I honestly, every single day, was just like, I was pulling my hair out. And nobody knew how to operate cameras. It was I just threw my old DVX-100s. I threw them into the, I bought way too many tapes. Like, I didn't have a proper crew that, we didn't have sound. We didn't have a sound mixer. We had a shotgun mic on the front of those. And then I had my friend Michelle Hunt. She gave me her 60D, but we only had one battery and we didn't have any SD. We only had a couple SD cards, which was where you store it. And I'm like, I never used it. I'm not a camera operator either. I'm a director. I've directed features, like written scripted features.
Except for this film.
This is my first documentary. So I called some of my friends who were documentary filmmakers and I was like, what do I do? Do I just do interviews ahead of time? Like, I didn't really know. So I just kind of guessed, you know. I said, I'm assuming I should interview everyone before we leave and ask them about how they feel about the trip and going on the trip and why they want to go and who are they, where are they from, like, you know, what's their... We were all strangers. Like, everybody just kind of, like, came through a friend of a friend. And then Gabe told us he's bringing his nephew, Chris Cowis, and I'm like, oh, good, he can help with all your pee bags and wheelchair stuff and stuff I don't really know about, which, of course, I learned about. And he said, well, there's a thing with him. I don't know how long he's going to last. And I said, why? And he said, well, he's, you know, he just got out of heroin rehab and he's, you know, also recovering from crystal meth and coke. And he's in a gang and on probation.
Let's go.
Let's do it. This is going to be awesome. Let's do this. I have a stunt background, so I still say this is the biggest stunt I've ever pulled off.
Is there a point where you just went, this is the best thing I could have ever done? You obviously knew it was going to be a good thing going into it. You wouldn't have said yes. But there had to be some moments along this journey where you just went, wow.
I mean, every single time we met someone, every single time, who heard about what Gabe was doing and why he was doing it and who he was and how he just wanted to inspire people and wanted to make a difference and you know, every single time, it was just another, yep, this is the right thing to be doing. You know, we'd meet people on the side of the road that would tell us incredible stories of their lives. And we met this one woman. This was actually a big national story. Her brother, this was in New Mexico, went in and murdered her entire family. And she wasn't home. She was supposed to be home. And weirdly, she stopped us on the side of the road. And she was in tears. You know, every day for her is a struggle to forgive her brother, to move on. And she was very spiritual and very religious and, you know, is now running her father's church. And she said to us, you know, every day is hard, but when I see someone like you and what you're doing, it makes me feel like, okay, I can overcome. And we prayed. It's in the movie, actually. There's just a little tiny piece of her. And it was just, it's just that kind of thing happened every single day.
So it's like human fuel, really.
It was totally human fuel. And I mean, every time when Gabe's like, oh God, I'm so tired. And I was like, I was so tired. We were all so tired. When is this going to be over? And then we'd meet people, somebody in a chair. We would go
when
out
you
of
needed
our way,
to meet them.
You know, and it was just every, it was all, and there's a moment in the film where Gabe is done and like done. And I mean, we, you know, we're right there. We're almost at the end. He's like, you know, he says it in the movie. And this, a deluge of children come out of the forest like a piece of magic. And it was just perfect timing. And I even looked at Gabe and I said, just in time. And he looks at me, he goes, just in time. And I felt like every day was just in time. Gabe and I never had fear on our minds, ever. We never thought about the trucks that were going 90 miles an hour next to us. Never, ever. And I actually did get hit by a truck. But
by the way, yeah.
Yeah, just like a brush. It wasn't too bad. And it was in pitch black and they didn't see us. It was our fault. Like we just ran out of road and light and at the last second. And this truck with those big bales, you know, an 18 wheeler with the bales of hay. Thank God it wasn't metal, you know. And he slowed down just in time, but he nicked me. Just, and I, you know, I fell over off my bike, but it was nothing. It was like a kiss.
So,
it was a kiss of reminder, like, dude, put on your life vest.
What's next for you? Like, what has happened since, and how has this changed? Because clearly you never thought this was a film you'd ever do in your life. You did this film, and now what? And now are you refreshed? Are you still, obviously you're not rock bottom, but are you thinking, I've done it, I can just do something else? Or are you back in?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't know. I feel very, I feel at a crossroads, you know. If I say I'm going to do something, I do it. And 4.5 years ago, I said I was going to do this. And I promised Gabe I would finish. And trust me, there were about 50 billion times that I just wanted to throw in the towel. Because documentary filmmaking is the hardest filmmaking there is. I don't care what anyone says.
Why?
Well, you know those puzzles? You get a puzzle and on the front there's like a picture of the Arc de Triomphe or the whatever it is. And then you just like look at the puzzle and you match up, right? You get the pieces that look like it. That's what you do when you have a feature film, like a narrative feature. You get the box and it's a screenplay. Swift. And you follow the screenplay. You know it. You cast it, you know. Documentary filmmaking, you get a black box, the cover's black, there's a question mark on the front. It says 25 million pieces can be put together in 75 million different ways. Good luck.
What's the biggest lesson you learned on this journey?
I can do whatever I want with my life. I can do whatever I want with it. I just have to figure out now what that is, you know? I just don't know right this minute. I'd love to make films. But I'm tired. I've been doing this for 21 years and I want a home, you know? I want a home. And that sounds really cheesy, but I want a home. I want a team that I can count on, you know? And I've made all my own homes and I've made my own teams. And I always tell, you know, young filmmakers and young actors and actresses, and I say, you got to make your own yeses. You have to make your own yeses, and until someone plucks you from obscurity. And I've been waiting to be plucked. You know, that leg up. You know, I've given so many people legs up. I have given so many of them. And I didn't do it for any reason. I just did it because I saw someone needed a leg up. They just needed to be hoisted out of there, you know? And I would like to get hoisted out.
You know, you'd love to stay in film, but who knows with this industry and financing, yeah, and everything. Yeah. So what is your ideal next job?
I was going to be a nurse. I love the medical field. I'm kind of obsessed with medical things. I went to school. I have a master's in health science. This film thing was almost an accident. I've been talking to some people about medical sales and medical training, specialists in different medical devices.
That was Lisa France, director and producer of the documentary Roll With Me, A Journey Across America, which has won various film festival awards and will be screened at the Slamdance Film Festival in Utah at the end of January. And if you're wondering whether the film was France's last, it was not. I checked in with France since our interview to learn she'd recently landed a job as a director for an independent film, a thriller. A growing number of veterans are women, but government research shows they do not use Veterans Affairs health care at the same rate as men. Some say they don't feel comfortable at VA clinics. In Los Angeles, there's a new effort to provide alternative care to female veterans. Libby Denkman reports.
For female troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, the line between combat and non-combat roles has long been blurred. That was a reality for Army medic Denise Berry when she was doing a maintenance check underneath an ambulance at a hospital in Iraq.
And we were mortared. So that means the porta potty and the person in it to my right was completely blown up, and my truck was blown up, but I was not.
She suffered memory loss related to traumatic brain injury and later symptoms of PTSD. But after getting out of the Army, Berry waited. She tried to tough out the disturbing dreams and anxiety alone.
How could I possibly receive benefits when this person over here is dealing with the ramifications of Agent Orange or lost a leg?
When she finally went to the VA, she felt unwelcome, as though doctors saw a fresh-faced, blonde young woman, not a veteran recovering from war zone trauma.
The first psychiatrist I went to kind of rolled their eyes at me and just said, you know, I really don't know why you're wasting my time, because there's nothing wrong with you.
Dr. Miata Snedder hears about experiences like Barry's a lot. She's a clinical psychologist for U.S. Vets, the largest veteran-specific housing and services nonprofit in the country. The VA has made changes to improve healthcare services for the growing number of female veterans, but Snedder says there are still a lot of obstacles, and the system can feel like a testosterone-only space.
Male veterans, their style of banter and communication is very, very different. Sometimes it can be triggering for female veterans, and they don't feel comfortable being in that kind of an environment.
Snedder is part of a team trying to close that gap with a new outreach program dubbed Women Vets On Point. It's aimed at overcoming barriers to care and connecting female veterans with a range of services in their community, including substance abuse treatment, housing, and domestic violence counseling outside the VA system.
We're going to go right in here. It's utilized, so we have this.
Snedder is showing me around the Veterans Resource Center at Fullerton College, one of several campuses where she treats student veterans.
So this is a very, very unique environment here on campus where veterans come, they feel safe, they feel comfortable, and they're still connected to the camaraderie that they're used to in the military.
Every Monday morning, Snedder provides individual therapy to veterans in an office down the hall. She says she wants to see more women knocking on her door and taking advantage of a range of nonprofit services assisting with the transition from military to civilian life.
Oftentimes, even in civilian populations, females are more of the nurturers. They're more apt to take care of others and see the problems and concerns and that others have and not really seeking help for themselves.
As part of a pilot program in Los Angeles County, Women Vets On Point is building a network of community partners that offer resources to female veterans and will award grants to improve those services. They're also building a website to help women find help quickly, like therapist offices with childcare nearby.
There are a lot of clinicians who would love to be able to provide services to female veterans. They don't know how.
One of the biggest challenges the new program is likely to face is winning the trust of female veterans. Many feel like the system let them down. They weren't taken seriously when they suffered mental health difficulties or the effects of sexual harassment and assault.
All of those experiences mean that it's harder for them to have faith in and connect to care.
Rebecca Stokel is with Education Development Center, a nonprofit research organization helping to develop Women Vets On Point.
They've had this cadence of experience. I reached out for help, I looked for help, and what was offered wasn't right for me. We need to do better than that.
Stokel says after an initial testing period, they hope to expand the program nationwide. In Los Angeles, I'm Libby Denkman.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1485.